Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Tonight is the second quarter wrap-up. I'll be going over our major theme infrastructure as well as the chief stories of the second quarter. We have a financial markets section also at our web presentation, but I went through the financial markets very carefully last week in equity overview. Because we've had so much action in the market since the end of the quarter, I'm going to do a separate money in markets. So if you want the latest on the markets, check out the money in markets audio, which is going to be separate. As we always do with the wrap-ups, we have a great web presentation for you. So if there's any way you can listen to the audio while trolling through the or watching the web presentation, they've got some great charts and graphs. So I would encourage you to take a look. Infrastructure through the ages. Infrastructure plays incredibly important roles, really determining sort of who wins, who doesn't, who lives, who dies. If you look at infrastructure, it's a critical ingredient of either winning at warfare or defending against those who do. It's also a very important way of managing and interacting with and leveraging nature. And then finally, it's great infrastructure makes it much easier for humans to be productive. The impact on society and the role of infrastructure is unbelievably important. I have recommended a couple of documentaries that you, if you're interested in this topic, that will really help you delve in. One is a series from the History Channel, Engineering an Empire, that goes through the efforts of 14 different civilizations throughout our history and describe the role of the infrastructure in terms of winning at warfare, defending against it, and also effective management of our natural resources. I also recommended The Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, which is a fabulous BBC documentary that tells the stories of six of the great industrial infrastructure projects and one of the biggest failures, the Great Eastern. And it describes the extraordinary impact that an infrastructure project can have on a society. These projects save lives, they lower transportation time and costs, they facilitate communication and trade. However, they're traditionally very, it's very challenging to build the financial and political constituencies you need to support them and make them happen. And so the challenges involved in getting your infrastructure right are many. The people who do are obviously in a very good position. I was really shocked. I spent my whole life among people who saw infrastructure as being very important. It was a topic that always had great electricity, great power to it. And I was really shocked when I started to speak publicly about the corruption, how little interest everyone had in infrastructure. And what I realized was that we really do have a celebrity-soaked media that has managed to persuade everyone. It's kind of a mind control that this is a boring topic and it puts everybody to sleep. And so I'm always trying to come up with ways of helping people understand or get inspired about infrastructure and kind of see it for what it is. And so I put up a couple of suggestions. I put up a great scene from the movie Margin Call about building a bridge. Also, two of my favorite software games that help you understand the power of infrastructure to build an economy within a place. One is called SimCity, and the other is Railroad Tycoon, which we used to play on the trading floor of Hamilton Securities long ago. A lot of the power of infrastructure you can see when you look at economics on a place-based basis. And for those of you who've been subscribers for a while, you know how important I think it is to be able to understand and see the place-based economics and investment around you and how wonderful it would be if we had the proper disclosure. We don't. A lot of the government disclosure is either very hard to understand or follow. And obviously no money has been put into making it accessible, or very little money has been put into making it accessible, because it's a real control issue to have that knowledge and not have the general population have it. But once you start to look at economics on a place-based basis, you start to understand, wow, the power of infrastructure. on the web presentation, I put up a link to the infrastructure entry at Wikipedia. It does a great job of branching into all the different areas of infrastructure. And if you want to get a great definition or explore it, I would really recommend you go to Wikipedia and see all the things that are involved, from transportation to power to water to roads to bridges to tunnels to suborbital space platforms to communication systems, cables under the ocean, on and on and on. It's think of all the physical stuff that levers the human race, and you're thinking about infrastructure. Okay, infrastructure's in the news for a variety of reasons, and if you look at the gist of it, essentially we are watching an explosion of demand for infrastructure around the world for several reasons, which I'm going to talk about. But it's happening at the same time that the 30-year bull market in government municipal bonds is either plateauing or coming to an end, which is and has been the primary source of financing infrastructure. So demands are skyrocketing just at the time that the traditional sources of financing it are going away. And it wouldn't surprise me if that expectation of that dynamic was one of the reasons we saw the financial coup d'etat, essentially the people running the planet saying, we're going to pull the money out in anticipation of this because we'd rather finance new infrastructure than nursing homes. So I don't think that's an accident. Let's talk about some of the things that are pushing infrastructure into the news. First of all, there's the rebalancing of the global economy. That means when you rebalance the global economy, it creates very different demands for infrastructure in different places. You have growth. Part of that is growth in the emerging markets. To keep that growth going, that's putting tremendous stress on their infrastructure. They have to build out the infrastructure going forward. And again, more investment in infrastructure and different kinds of infrastructure. Third, we now have 9 billion people on the planet. It's putting enormous environmental stress. Great infrastructure can dramatically reduce our environmental impact on a per-person basis, but obviously it requires design, collaboration, investment, and building out that infrastructure. Fourth, we're making a big push into outer space, and that means building a whole new infrastructure in the suborbital platform, as well as building the infrastructure we need to get into space and, you know, build colonies on Mars. And finally, new technology means you have significant opportunities to adapt your existing infrastructure, build new infrastructure, integrating that technology in it, and also to re-optimize your system so that you don't need to build new infrastructure. So you can organize your roads and your tolls with smart technology so that you re-optimize how traffic flows, when it flows. Some very interesting things in Australia they've been doing with that. And new technology makes for all sorts of different possibilities. So if you look at all of these different factors together, we're talking about an increased demand for infrastructure. McKinsey just did a study in 2013 and estimated global infrastructure spending between now and 2030 should be about $57 trillion. And I have a chart up that shows the estimate of the sort of where it's, you know, the different areas in which they anticipate that to occur. Roads, rail, ports, airports, power, water, telecom. They don't include space. Space would add more to that $57 trillion. So let's look at some of the variables that are underscoring the importance of societal infrastructure. First and foremost, the U.S. has fallen behind. The U.S. has made significant investment in what I call its control infrastructure of the last 50 years. So we've built underground bases. We've put money in space. We've built a lot of money into the information systems as surveillance systems. But we've fallen behind in the traditional economy. If you travel in Asia or Europe, it can be very embarrassing because you feel like you're from a third world country now, not from a first world country, when you compare the infrastructure in America to Singapore or Sweden or Switzerland or other countries that have done a very good job in this area. The emerging markets, as I said, the emerging markets, if they're going to maintain their growth, they've got to build forward into infrastructure. Infrastructure is very much constraining growth in places like India and Brazil. The greatest needs are in the BRIC nations, and they constitute the significant or the significant driver for growth within the G20. So now that's interesting because for the first time, if you look at demands for infrastructure, the total dollars are greater in the BRIC nations than they are in the United States. And really, they're greater in the BRIC nations than the United States and Europe. And part of it is you just got a whole lot more people. And so that's a shift in the balance of power because we now see the Chinese and the BRICS coming together and putting together independent ways of financing infrastructure. And that's a real power issue for the West. Megacities, the global population is clearly urbanizing. Right now, there are 27 cities with populations that are numbering greater than 10 million people. If you're going to have that kind of density, then there's a great focus that needs to be made on what's the infrastructure that supports them and how can you re-engineer functions to get great transportation, for example, without everybody owning their own car. And that's why you're seeing things like Zipcar and Uber and many other systems to avoid what would happen if 10 million people in one dense place all tried to have cars. Finally, as we've talked about much on the Solari Report, the Silk Road is part of this because you've got a rising Asia and you've got a wealthy Europe, and the opportunity to build out the Silk Road is just exploding, and that's part of what the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was about. So, and you know, if you haven't listened to our annual report for that we did in January, I strongly recommend it because we talk a lot about the Silk Road. Finally, the BRICS are, as I said, are leaving the G7 nest. Then they've created a new development bank. There's an Asian bond fund, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, a new Silk Road fund company in China. I've put up the links, and you can start to look at the BRICS as they've gotten more frustrated with the IMF and the World Bank and sort of G7 control. They're leaving the nest and they're putting together the kind of arrangements they need to start doing more of this infrastructure because they have more than the majority of demand, and they can't wait for G7 or the West to facilitate that demand. They've got to do it themselves. Another issue that I think is important to what we're seeing happen in the conversation about infrastructure and why it's important is the growth of the sovereign wealth funds. You have, I did a review in the second quarter on the sovereign wealth funds, which I encourage you to take a look at. You have more and more countries, primarily countries that have been highly dependent on commodities and natural resources. As they've sold down and extracted their natural resources, they've taken a portion, put it in sovereign wealth funds. As those funds grow in size and strategic importance, they offer an opportunity for long-term thinking about what you need if you're going to get good returns on investment. Infrastructure is absolutely strategically important to getting long-term good returns in the certainly in the equity markets, and to make sure that a lot of bond issues are creditworthy. So infrastructure goes to the heart of the efficiency and the productivity of global society. And so to me, the sovereign wealth funds offer an opportunity because their mandate, and each is different, I don't want to overgeneralize, but their mandate really includes looking at how to optimize investment returns, both in their national area and regional area, but globally. New technology is having an explosive impact on everything. We have much lighter materials that offer lots of opportunities for infrastructure. New fabrication technology makes it much easier, quicker to build things, and disperses who can build them. So it's not only making things more faster to build and at lower cost, but it means more people can get into the game. You also have breakthrough energy technology. I'm not suggesting that it's going to be integrated, but if it does, it's going to have a radical impact on everything, including the cost of everything. Digital systems not only change what you can do with infrastructure, but how you can change the surrounding ecosystem to delete the need to build more physical infrastructure. And then, of course, we have things like robotics and drones. All of this is having a dramatic impact on the opportunities. We have to upgrade our existing infrastructure and to build new infrastructure. Communications technology, I think, is particularly important. Anyway, as these new technologies come online in all areas of the economy, that's going to create additional capacity, which could be used to focus on infrastructure. For example, robotics. If you look at how many people who are currently employed who will no longer be needed once robotics and artificial intelligence get integrated, what that does is that frees up a lot of people to start paying attention to infrastructure. So we're going to start seeing capacity become available, and it's very important to create the opportunity for that capacity to start doing things we very much need. Space becoming a multi-planetary civilization. As I've said many times, the U.S. and Mr. Global have made a commitment to become a multi-planet society. That absolutely means, same as robotics, and I believe it's connected, you need massive increases in productivity in our manufacturing base if you're going to produce the stuff that's going to make that possible. And what that means is we have to have a significant investment of infrastructure if we're going to get that kind of productivity. Finally, we're switching from what I call the 2.0 to 3.0 economy. I've talked a lot about that in the last two wrap-ups, and then in the third quarter wrap-up last year, I went through all the different specific areas that are going to be real areas of opportunity in 3.0. But obviously, if you go through that third quarter wrap-up and look at the different areas, what you'll see, it clearly changes what our vision for infrastructure is and what's possible and what we need. Okay, so let's turn to the unique trends to consider. There's a whole bunch of, because infrastructure goes to the heart of just about everything. It really is at the center of things. There are a couple of different trends I want to just point out that make designing and implementing infrastructure tricky right now. The first is covert goals versus productivity and risk management. There are numerous reasons why our society keeps infrastructure building and infrastructure goals secret, and that includes national security and business competition. The problem is that secrecy often comes at a very high cost. It leads to this Orwellian world where the official explanations are very, very different than what's really going on, and that can create all sorts of misunderstandings. You don't get the benefits of group intelligence when you have open source design and analysis and the competition associated with it. You get a much better result. Secrecy, in particular, protects incompetence, and you get mediocre people rising who are good at lying and stealing or using force to assert themselves, but lousy at getting things done in the real world, including building infrastructure. That's what you get when you get bridges that fall down. There is significant global infrastructure investment right now, which is engineered in secret. And I think managing infrastructure's going needs while maintaining that secrecy is part of the reason for the push for central control and sort of dumbing people down. And I should also mention there is a long historical relationship between wanting to amass significant resources for infrastructure, and if you do it in secret, then you end up with totalitarian systems, and that includes slave labor. And that's a real concern. So I'm someone who always argues for transparency around these issues, because if you look at what we need to do in the infrastructure area, to the extent that that's driving the desire for totalitarian systems, we want to nip that in the bud because we don't want to all end up as slave labor. And if you look at some of the different, if you go back and listen to the Soleri report, that I did with Adam Trombley on entrainment technology. It's one of the reasons I'm so concerned about that, because slave labor does not necessarily require the traditional physical chains. It can also have electronic chains as well. Power and currency wars. One of the challenges you have in designing infrastructure right now is the U.S. dollar is based on a fossil fuel standard. And that means your currency model and your global investment model are all tied into what your energy sources are. And for planning of infrastructure, it would be a lot easier if they weren't tied in, if you could do the currency separate from having to rig one of your most important energy components into one thing. So just remember, a jump the curve infrastructure plan also may require a shift out of the 500-year-old central banking warfare model, and that's a very big change. It also can help explain why the China's Asian Investment Bank is causing so much panic amidst the leadership. Planet debt. We talked about planet debt in the first quarter. And as I said, one of the big issues with the long-term bull market in bonds coming to a close, we've literally stockpiled trillions of dollars in the bonds and derivative money markets. If we're going to move that out into other parts of the real economy, the question is, where is all that money going to go? Now, there are plenty of places in the real economy for that money to go, but they can't go into the real economy without a significant upgrade in infrastructure, because the global economy can't handle that level of investment productively unless we make those kinds of investments in infrastructure. Now, in fact, that money can be a source of investment for infrastructure. And as I said, there's plenty of money, but it's a bit of a dance. You bring that money out into the real economy, and then you're going to have to flip to an equity model. And it's a very different model than the central banking warfare model, which brings us to planet equity, which we focused on in the annual wrap-up. And of course, again, if that money's going to come out, where is it going to come out? Who's going to manage it? And are they going to be willing to invest in infrastructure? One part of that question is, we're now spending $1.7 trillion on military budgets on the record, and even more off the record. And so the reality is, you know, do we want to spend trillions every year on infrastructure to make war on each other, or do we want to spend trillions on getting this shift to an equity model in the infrastructure right, and breaking away the capacity to go into space? So these are very big questions, and they're right. That's why I say we're at the crossroads. They're right at the heart of all the different issues we're looking at, whether it's currency, investment model, or infrastructure. Another one, again, rebalancing the global economy, enhancing productivity for space exploration. If we're going to become a multi-planet civilization, that has dramatic impacts for infrastructure, and dramatic opportunities, because if you look at how much we're going to have to gather in terms of resources and what we're going to need to commit, this is a very, very big commitment. And that's why there's no reason for collapse. There's plenty to do if we're prepared to do it. Environmental alignment, we're putting tremendous stress on the planet, first and foremost with geoengineering and manipulation of the planet's electromagnetic field. Whatever's going on, it's clear if we redesign, redo our infrastructure, we can significantly realign our relationship with natural ecosystems. I, for one, believe that's going to take bringing disclosure to place-based economics so that people can, you know, make the right choices. But that's a topic for another day. Municipal investment. Municipalities have traditionally been a very important source of financing for infrastructure projects, and I think they're going to continue to be. But as you integrate new technology and you collaborate broadly with other municipalities, governments, and regional associations, as well as local businesses and citizens, there's a whole new way of doing it that has municipalities playing a very important leadership role. But moves infrastructure to a much wider constituency and amasses much more resources. Insurance and risk, typically the only thing that gets constructed is something that can get insurance for construction. Future infrastructure investment is going to be influenced by what insurance companies are willing to underwrite and how they price the risk. And that's one of the reasons why I don't believe infrastructure investment, despite all the hoopla about privatization, will be a private affair. It's very much going to remain the domain of governments to handle the risk. But it will be very important that we do whatever it takes to make sure insurance companies are available and insurance capacity is available to handle the risk issues. Employment, robotics, artificial intelligence, all these forms of automation are in the process of radically re-engineering productivity across the society, and that's going to include outsourcing more white-collar work from the G7 into the global economy. So this process is going to continue, and now it's going to move upscale and hit the white-collar hard. We're hearing more and more politicians calling for infrastructure investment as a way to keep people employed. What I would say is that's a very bad idea. It's very important to organize infrastructure around that which produces the best total economic return to the, whether it's the national or regional or global economy as a whole, and then help your workforce build a pathway to learn the skills or to retool to do that. Because the thing that will create the most jobs is the most economic health. And so you want to design your infrastructure to build the most economic health and then help your workforce take advantage of that. And those are two separate things. You don't want to organize your infrastructure around what creates jobs for the current workforce. You want to help the workforce adapt to whatever creates the most for everybody. And that will end up with a lot more employment for those people than sort of pork barrel will. Okay, so let's turn to the next section, governance, the make or break question. And I think this is not intuitively obvious to a lot of people. You have to think about it for a little bit, but this is important. It's one of the reasons I keep coming back and you hear me hammer on governance. The people you need to steal $40 trillion are very different than the people you need to reinvest the money you stole. So Mr. Global is going to need to make a turn. We have had, in a financial coup d'etat, we've had a leadership that was great at financial fraud. They were great at secrecy. They were great at killing. I keep quoting Leonard Cohen's marvelous line, "We were blinded by the beauty of our weapons." So, you know, these are folks who steal, kill, you know, we're basically talking about racketeering and mobsterism. And those folks are great if you want to shake down the emerging markets or the frontier markets, shake people down and get natural resources cheap and get lots of money rolling into global foundations to finance and provide low cost cost of capital to your corporations. But the reality is, if you turn to those people and you ask them to design and lead great infrastructure within government, you end up with fees for your friends, you end up with kickbacks, you end up with bridges that fall down. Their skills are not appropriate. And if you look at the leadership question, right now U.S. leadership largely consists of wealthy lawyers. And what do lawyers do? They make rules, they pass laws, they litigate, they create tax loopholes to fund global foundations and endowments. If you look at China's leadership, if you look at their political leadership, you know, they're primarily trained as engineers. What do engineers do? They build bridges, they build high-speed trains, they build power plants, they build desalination plants, spaceships. It's a very, very different kind of leadership. And so the question, if you look, it's interesting, and I posted links to the McKinsey Global Institute, which has a lot of good studies on the economy, published in 2013 a study on infrastructure and followed it up with one in 2015 on productivity and then another little one, and I've put the links up. And basically what they say is, look, we can do this $57 trillion, but we got to get massively more productive which we can. But what does that mean? It means professional leadership and professional management focused on getting $57 trillion of highly effective and efficient projects done. Again, a very, very different leadership. Now, if you go to the countries in this world that have great first-rate infrastructure, so go to Sweden, go to Switzerland, go to Singapore, or if you review the successful projects that are happening today or being proposed, and I link to a whole group of them so you can troll around and take a look, you know, clearly the world has the capacity to produce great infrastructure, and clearly the United States has that capacity. And why we're doing it, you know, that's the question. I put up a quote from Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson in an interview that we did earlier this year in the Solaria Report. And I want to read it to you because I think it's that important. Because I think this is the most important issue, step one to getting great infrastructure and jumping the curve on this whole shift, whether it's the central banking warfare model to where we're going next, whether it's getting the infrastructure right, whether it's getting the capacity to go into space. It depends on this issue. So let me read my interview with Colonel Wilkerson. So I had asked him, the 2016 elections, do you think there are national security issues that are going to emerge in those elections? Is there any hope that we'll get an intelligent discussion on a national level? And he says, I would hope so, but I don't think so. And what would that consist of? In my mind, first and foremost, it would consist of articulating some type of what I'll call, because I'm a military guy, a grand strategy to which the United States is going to hook up its economic engine. That would also include necessarily a revival of that engine. What you've got to do is say, what are we wanting to do in the world, and how are we going to refurbish our economy to do it? You aren't going to do anything of note or of consequence until you have done just that, refurbish your economy. That means $2, $3, or $4 trillion worth of expenditure on infrastructure. It means not building the old infrastructure, but building the new infrastructure, and that's where your grand strategy comes in. What is that new infrastructure? It's got to be sustainable. It's got to be resilient. It's probably got to be metroplex-oriented. That is urban-oriented, not vast sprawl across the country or in it. And it's got to be light rail-oriented, walkable and bicyclable, community-oriented. It's got to be light energy footprint-oriented. It's got to do away with automobiles and highways and so forth. And it's got to tax waste instead of wealth, at least for an interim period. It's got to do all these things that are going to prepare the U.S. economy to be hooked up to this strategy and to make this strategy work. I don't see Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, or anyone who's capable of doing that, or worse, wanting to do that. So then I said, from what I've seen, and I don't really follow it, they're much more interested in people who believe in monopoly. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, they're more interested in power, period, and they think that's where the power is. I've got news for them. I just sat on the Climate Security Working Group now for a year. I switched over from a collaborative institute on oceans and climate security at UMass Boston, and we've been working with DOD. We just did some sea rise charts for coastal installations like Norfolk and Mayport, San Francisco, San Diego, and so forth. Let me tell you, these entities are either going to spend billions of dollars for Netherlands-like water abatement apparatuses, walls, and so forth, or they're going to relocate. This is billions and billions of dollars. Miami is going to have to do this. We already have a problem in Norfolk, and we've already got a problem with Langley Air Force Base, which you wouldn't think you would have where TAC headquarters is, because the runways are being flooded. This is serious. This is real and not mid-century. It's just a few years away. Now, when you think about it, given the future of the U.S. dollar as reserve currency depends on the success of the U.S. Navy, which means, you know, yeah, you better get this right. This is about real power. And yet, you know, no interest from a lot of wealthy lawyers running for president. And that's really what they are. They're wealthy lawyers, and they rose to power. Certainly the Bushes and the Clintons in the financial coup period. And it's a different set of skills we need now. To bring the point home, I decided for a Let's Go to the Movies this week, and for the second quarter wrap-up, I would use the Worker Trilogy, which is one of the most magnificent productions I've seen in a long time. It's by playwright David Hare, who's clearly one of the great playwrights living today. It's a three-movie series written and directed for the BBC by Hare, and it tells the story of the Gladstone Group, a syndicate of New Jersey businessmen and investors who are grossly overbilling the CIA for the construction of secret torture and rendition sites. And a portion of their padding is going for kickbacks to a global foundation, which is soon to be launched by the British Prime Minister when he retires from office. And the foundation's stated goals are, of course, humanitarian works, all financed by kickbacks on construction on secret torture and rendition sites globally. The movie pits an honest member of the MI5 civil service up against a group of sort of corrupt politicians, businessmen, and private investors, all who are lining their pockets. And it's a reminder of how expensive our current leadership is. And it was a very interesting experience for me to watch it, because I rose to success as a professional by financing infrastructure. I did a lot of infrastructure when I was on Wall Street, and yet when I got to the Bush administration and then started my own company, I got very crosswise of the people that I financed that infrastructure for and with, because if you looked at what they were doing, they had stopped financing the New York City subway system and new turnpikes and other infrastructure I thought of as very important, and they were busy financing private prisons and information control systems that did surveillance and rendition and torture sites around the world. It's almost as though they lost their mind and went crazy on prisons and control systems and practicing literally slave labor. It was very Nazi-esque. And you wonder why would they take such a significant portion of Americans' infrastructure business and literally waste it accordingly? Now, I'm sure they would say not all of it was wasted. Some was stolen and went down to the black budget for the kind of weapons they needed to do all of this. But you can see when you you watch the Warwicker trilogy, the extent to which an entire society went off on this tangent. So Warwicker trilogy, if you haven't seen it, it's great theater. I recommend it, and some very important insights on what's going on in our world. There's one other issue I wanted to bring up in the governance topic, because it's very relevant. We are watching every day more and more of our infrastructure redesigned for digital systems. So you read in the paper or the news about the Internet and Things, driverless cars, robots, smart meters connected to home appliances. All these things depend on digital systems, and what we are also seeing is proof that the digital systems don't have integrity, whether they have zero privacy or whether they're being used for cyber warfare. Cybersecurity issues are just skyrocketing, and if the digital systems have little integrity and so can easily be hacked, why would we even want them? If passenger planes can have their remote control piloting systems hijacked, if driverless cars can suddenly be hijacked and kill investigative reporters and so forth, if our washing machines are too complicated and we can't fix them and they keep breaking down, why bother to own them? So I think all these grand plans of reengineering things for great communication systems are about to smack head into the tsunami that these systems don't have any kind of integrity in a variety of different ways. And that takes us back to the issue of, are we going to use all this stuff to kill each other, or are we going to use it to build economies? It's the control versus, or the conquest versus creation topic. And I think it's really going to come out in the cybersecurity issues and the digital infrastructure. Okay, so governance, if we want to have great infrastructure, you know, we can't have everything run by lawyers. It's just not, certainly not corrupt lawyers. So it's nothing like a great lawyer who's not corrupt, and I'm alive because of them, so I don't want to smear all lawyers. But I have to tell you, when your entire legislature is nothing but lawyers, you have a problem. You need engineers. Next section, the intimate opportunity, just do it, infrastructure. There are 4 points I want to bring across in this section, because whatever the grand vision is and whatever the schemes are, we can't wait for those. We're going to have to just do it. So there are 4 points I want to impress. The first one is take action. If you live in an area where infrastructure is falling behind, you need to face that. You need to look at the impact it's having on your health, your business, your effectiveness, your finances, your competitive position across the board. If you don't understand what I mean, go travel to Switzerland or Sweden or Singapore and see what it's like to live in a place that's got a great infrastructure. So you either need to develop strategies to outwit the harm that's being done to your time and productivity from living with a lousy infrastructure, or you need to move. But whatever you need to do, you need to identify what is happening and take it into account. Don't let poor infrastructure steadily eat away at your resources. Two, you need to identify opportunities. The reality is that all the changes that we've been talking about is now opening up more and more of infrastructure to smaller groups, to entrepreneurs, to communities, to sort of groups who just do it. I published in the web presentation the Guernsey Experience story, a wonderful story that was published up at Sam Smith's Progressive Review about Guernsey, which is an island state in the British Channel Islands, that just started issuing its own paper so that it could start doing lots of infrastructure projects around Guernsey. And of course, it triggered a massive increase in the economy without triggering any inflation. There were interest-free state issued notes. And it's a story that is an example of why I'm so big on local currencies, equity crowdfunding, and place-based data banks and financial disclosure. These are all financial tools that if we were free to use them without interference, you would see an explosion of investment in local development. You got a lot of people sitting around without jobs, and you got a lot of tasks that need to be done and much upgrading in the quality of the physical infrastructure and the quality of the care for the land. So these kinds of financial tools are very, very important, and freedom to use them would, I think, result in tremendous increases. And now that crowdfunding is becoming more popular, that's one. I put up several examples of communities or entrepreneurs who'd use crowdfunding to do things. One was the Denver Bike Lane and a civic center in Wales. I also put up an example of a German project, because energy is a very important issue for local areas if you can reduce your energy costs, but I put up a story of a German village that brought up its own power grid. A story in Portland where the water system now has extra component in the pipes, and as the water flows through, they're having it generate electricity. So the story is Portland to generate electricity within its own pipes. Another example of what I call stacking functions explores the possibility of building roads with solar panels. It was a crowdfund by a group of entrepreneurs that gathered a lot of energy over the last year. Another story of entrepreneurs in Holland who are using three robotics that do 3D printing, that are literally 3D printing bridges across canals in Amsterdam. Again, an example of what the new tools can do. I put up links to the Global Village Construction Set. We had March Jakubowski on the Salera Report 2 years ago, as well as Dale Dougherty on the Maker Movement. We're starting to see all the collaborative practices that happened with open source software now moving into hardware. And of course, hardware gets you into infrastructure and building infrastructure. And then I talked two examples in the transportation area of improved communications technologies being used to change. One is a transportation services with small buses that now competes with the municipal. We're seeing entrepreneurs move in on the municipal market, clearly. And then Zipcar, the drivers, citizens sharing cars on a private basis instead of owning their own. I wanted to stress also that building out infrastructure does not just require high-tech solutions. One of my favorite and our hero of the year recently was Alfred Moser, who is the inventor who came up with a solution that would allow homes to be lit with recycled soda bottles. You put water in the soda bottle, turn it upside down on the roof, and suddenly it's bringing in the sunlight from the sky. It's a perfect example of something that dramatically replaces a huge amount of power plant capacity, costs very little money, and recycles soda bottles, the plastic that's messing up the world. And then a link to Pam Warhurst, who converted local landscapes into gardens in her village in the UK. Anyway, these are all wonderful examples that show you sort of major impact, just do-it-yourself infrastructure projects. So the second thing is, you know, take a look at how the world is changing and see where the opportunities are to just do it, including it, you know, that could be a business opportunity for some of us. Number three, the kids are enormous natural resource or an untapped resource for thinking about designing, analyzing, and finding opportunities in the infrastructure area. And so, number three, please engage with the kids. I put up two examples that we've used on the Solaria Report of kids who are just making life-changing contributions. One was 16-year-old Irish girls who came up with a crop yield breakthrough, which would dramatically change. If you can get your existing land and existing irrigation systems to produce far more in crops, you lower the stress on the infrastructure budget, obviously. And then a Vancouver high school student who developed an air circulation system for aircraft cabins, remarkable. And so if you can use that to convert your existing planes or to upgrade your planes, again, another big impact. And it's all from using innovation in your intelligence to do things as opposed to spend more money on more planes. It seems to me if we have our kids sitting around doing standardized testing in Common Core curriculum, which is a complete waste of their time, in my opinion, we could at least have them spending all that time doing open source analysis and design of our infrastructure. Now, clearly, don't wait for the schools to make these changes. You know, we can all, in how we buy books, DVDs, games, or engage with kids, the trips we take them on, what we teach them, we can start to engage with them on infrastructure now, teach them how empires have been engineered historically or how the great industrial projects made a huge difference. So do that now, because if you look at where their future opportunities lie to contribute, it's going to be as engineers, it's going to be as municipal leaders, it's going to be as entrepreneurs, it's going to be as founders of startup companies, it's going to be as people who can build their own home or design their own gray water system. So dealing with the hardware of our society is going to be a big opportunity over the next 20 years. If we're going to spend $60 trillion as a society globally on infrastructure, that's going to create a lot of opportunity. So you want to get your kids and your grandkids thinking about where the opportunities are for them to contribute. I said when I wrote the web presentation, I know there's someone out there thinking, look, we can't do this. There's no money. It's all going to collapse. And I put up the link to participatory budgeting. If you get a hold of all the budgets for your town and your region and you start digging in and looking where all the money's been going, I assure you there's plenty of money to do things with if we reorganized and reoptimized the money. But it starts with transparency and looking at the place-based economics in our place and then getting the political leverage we need to stop wasting money on, you know, just an endless number of things that have been pumped up in price by politics or fees for our friends. So the money's there. We might have to dig in and figure it out. Number four, consider the impact on your investments. We're going to be seeing infrastructure emerge as an important topic for investors. There are more and more funds and ETFs which focus on infrastructure now. Traditionally, they've underperformed the broader market. Whether that will continue to be so or not, I don't know. But I think we're going to be seeing more funds, more ETFs. And we're going to see more startup companies that serve niches in the infrastructure market. There are already several large publicly traded U.S. and European engineering companies that serve growing infrastructure demands, but I think we'll see more startups and more publicly traded companies that fit into that space. There's going to be a lot of pressure on governments to privatize operations, particularly that can cash flow positively in the private market. I think that general trend has not worked very well, so it's not one I promote. I do think the big infrastructure investment is going to have to be led and organized by national governments and their consortiums or state governments where the state's big enough. And that's because the infrastructure is such an important ingredient to regional economic performance, and constructing it requires building lots of different constituencies and lots of risk management. And so it's going to continue to be the domain of government. At the same time, it's going to be very important to the regional economic performance, and so the trading of place-based ETFs. So as we see more of the equity markets financing and trading on a place-based basis through the ETFs, I think there's going to be more and more stress, same as the sovereign wealth funds. The more you have the place-based equity, the more that equity is going to be concerned on what it's going to take to get the returns long-term, and that's always going to bring you back to infrastructure. And finally, with economic warfare raging globally, infrastructure is going to be at the heart of geopolitics. So it's not surprising to see that the Asians put together, the Chinese put together the Asian investment, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. It's so successful, it royally upsets the United States. And we see the United States in a panic get fast-tracked passed, and then I suspect have something very big to do with crashing the Chinese equity markets. I think the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank and its success in terms of attracting members from Europe was a big wake-up call for the Americans, and it's going to be one of the things that causes the Americans to start talking up infrastructure a lot more. They gave away the lead here, and I think they're going to be scrambling to think about how they get it back, not to mention the fact that fast track is going to cause trade both in the Atlantic and the Pacific to kick up when those agreements get passed. And that's going to call for far more infrastructure as well. Okay, so that's it. Let's just close with my little comment about standing at the crossroads, conquest or creation. There are a lot of big questions we have about what's going on planet Earth, and they run through infrastructure as well. Who's running things? Why are they acting the way they are? Why so many secrets? Why so many lies? And it all comes down to the multiple personality disorder world we're living in. You know, are we going to use the internet for communicating or for cyber warfare? Are we going to use drones for delivering packages or bombs? Are we going to build infrastructure? Are we going to blow it up? The United States has quite a record now, particularly in the Middle East, of blowing up infrastructure. And so I think the question is it going to be conquest or creation? But if you look at the crossroads that we've come into in terms of the central banking warfare model wearing very thin, we clearly have three options economically. We can depopulate, we can go to war, or we can change. And the reality is the change pathway is a pathway that's going to involve designing and creating and investing in a great amount of infrastructure. And so if you want to improve the odds for change, then we need to all get busy building, and we need to support the idea of infrastructure, because we need the talent and the capacity of the world building things together. The more we build these things together, the less we're inclined to blow each other up. And so depopulation, war, change, my vote is for change. I think infrastructure is the heart, at the very heart of making a successful change. And so if you want change and you want creation, I want you to start thinking at a minimum that infrastructure is a much more interesting, inspiring topic than you might think otherwise. That's it for infrastructure. And again, I would encourage you to take a look at the wonderful web presentation that the Solari team did for you You can link to it from the blog post or the wrap-up library. Okay, top stories for the second quarter. If you click over to stories and trends, let me just walk through the big areas. The second quarter was quite a dynamic period. A top story, in my opinion, was deflation wars. We see the turn finally in the bond market upon us. And in fact, I wrote a commentary called The Turn Upon Us. Part of what's happening and part of the deflation is the automation. So there's another commentary I wrote called Dollar Robot. But we had Greece and Puerto Rico ring the bell in the second quarter, both saying the debt's not sustainable and we're not going to try and sustain it. We can't. And so kick the can is over. And we're now going to start to deal with the fact that we've piled money high in the bond market and it needs to be written off or marked to market. We've shifted the debt from the banks into the sovereign governments, some into the central banks who are clearly shredding it and tearing it up. But we're going to have to deal with this all across society. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about infrastructure in the second quarter is that money, if that money is going to move out of the bond market and into the real economy, then we're going to have to invest in infrastructure. There's been a lot of discussion about debt and how you deal with the debt. And I put some links up to some of the articles, some good pieces from The Economist and one IMF economist who came out and said, stop worrying about the debt. Now, we saw the competition between Russia and China and the United States kick up even more. The United States had a panic attack about the extraordinary success between Europe and Asia on the Chinese Infrastructure Investment Bank, and I think that's part of what got the fast track pushed through. We spent a lot of time in the second quarter talking about fast track and what it means because it's a revolution in the legal and financial structure globally. And we have another special report coming. We did one on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is up. We have another one coming on the Trade Services Agreement shortly. So this process is one that's going to roll out. But I think a lot of what you saw happen on the Trans-Pacific Partnership was, and Fast Track was a real concern, that China and Europe were getting together on the Silk Road and the U.S. was going to be cut out. Baltimore, we had riots in Baltimore and a lot of attention paid to what was really going on in Baltimore. And I think the important thing about Baltimore was how much more intelligent the crowd is getting. The American people, whether they lived in Baltimore or were watching Baltimore, didn't fall for the old tricks. We had the Crips and the Bloods stand up and basically dispute what was being said about them in the press and what was being said about what was really going on. We had real questions about the fact that people who were working Ferguson in Missouri on social media also were working Baltimore, and some of them were paid by a Soros front group. So very interesting. Junius Ricardo Stanton and I did a Salera report called Unpacking Baltimore. And I think the message of Baltimore is the old tricks aren't working. You know, Hillary Clinton stood up and said, oh, we need a revolutionary new policy. And I think it fell very flat. And so the message of Baltimore is the divide and conquer is hot and heavy, but I don't think it's working the way they were hoping. The skimming continues, still tremendous money missing from Pentagon, missing from things going on in the Middle East, and you know, the money that keeps disappearing is huge. Lots of talk about infrastructure, and we put some of those links up. It's one of the reasons we wanted to do the infrastructure for the second quarter wrap-up theme. The education tsunami continues. We had a great interview on Common Core. And Common Core has turned out to be a major political issue. Jeb Bush coming out for Common Core, and it's giving him a very big problem, and it shows you how angry people are about this. And then under the category other stories, a lot of stuff going on. California passed mandatory vaccinations. It's pretty scary and outrageous. If you have kids and you live in California, you really need to think about what you're going to do, because I put up a link to John Rappaport's story about this. California is ordering genetic alteration. This is very scary stuff, so you want to pay attention. Pope Francis came out with a new encyclical, and we published it and dealt with several thousand dollars worth of hacking. But his encyclical shows the extraordinary disconnect between what the Pope is saying and what the church is doing and how the church has made its money and the source of all the money sitting in the church and church-related endowments. So there's a real disconnect between what they're saying and what they're doing, and it's going to be interesting to see how they, like all of us, deal with that disconnect. Clinton Cash, I wrote a piece really last week on the book Clinton Cash, but one of the things that it describes in it, and this one of the stories I posted, the Red Cross raised $500 million for Haiti but built just six homes, is extraordinary. Whether it was the Clinton Foundation, the Red Cross, huge amounts of money built on Haiti, but of course the Haitians never saw any of it, or what they saw is a very token amount. Finally, big consternation on the Ukraine, and I put up stories on Kerry basically getting sidelined out of the Ukraine policy. It's a little bit scary to see what's going on, and it's not unconnected to what's happening in Greece, because the Russians are hoping to build a pipeline now through Turkey and Greece to bring gas into Europe and Germany and cut out the Ukraine altogether. So the Silk Road politics and the pipeline politics continue apace, and the Ukraine continues to be a major hotspot. Clearly, I'm not going to go through the financial markets. The charts we have up are the ones we did for the second quarter ending June 30. But clearly, the markets came down a lot in the second quarter. We had very strong markets, particularly in Europe and China. Germany, China, Europe, and the Asia and the emerging markets were much stronger than expected. And they came down a fair amount in the second quarter, but still strong gains for the year, and then have gotten absolutely decimated since July 1st. And so in a trading week since then, we've seen quite a significant correction. So I'll talk in money markets about what's happened since June 30. But if you want the charts as of June 30, just click over to financial markets. And as I said, I went through those in detail in the equity overview. So if you're interested and you want to hear that audio, then just click over and listen to last week's second quarter equity overview. Okay, so that's it for top stories and trends. I just have to say in closing that this every quarter, our work on the wrap-up is very, very gratifying for me personally. My goal with the wrap-ups is to say, okay, four times a year, if I can talk about the big themes and then the trends and the stories that were most important, how can you, as a very busy person, if you could only listen to four wraps up a year, you would have an absolute mastery of what's going on. And so that's my goal. For our next wrap-up, our big theme is going to be the Chinese stock markets, because what's happening in the markets there is so very interesting to the build-out and the development of Planet Equity, and it's part of leading me into a conversation about the impact of sovereign wealth funds on what's happening globally. So if you have any comments or thoughts, either about that or about other themes that you would like us to address through the wrap-ups, I would encourage you to let us know. It's very, very important to me that these wrap-ups serve you well. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for second quarter wrap-up. Thank you for a great quarter. We love what we do, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to serve you.